Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin, joined again today by Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. Top of the morning, Josh.
Top of the morning to you.
So we are coming to you a day or so early this week, I guess, for scheduling reasons. Today, we thought we'd do, you know, a little bit of a drill down into one of the big topics that's preoccupying the Capitol crew in Texas right now. And if you're a national politics person, you know, I hope you don't just tune out right away. But, you know, this probably has some larger implications. But if you're in, you know, the world of the Capitol right now or following Texas politics very closely, and it does require certainly very closely is one of the themes today. Mm-hmm. What you're looking at is the unfolding speaker's race in the Texas House of Representatives. What we thought we'd do is look at some of the data we have on the Texas speaker and related issues. This could take us a few places. We'll see how far we get, but let's dive down on this. So, you know, we kind of start in terms of thinking about public opinion related to the Speaker of the House with, you know, the nugget of historical conventional wisdom that all things being equal, you know, the more a speaker is a matter of public discussion and is known to the public, the less good it is for his standing and for his politics. And, you know, this is an artifact of as I've called, conventional wisdom, you know, that goes back to a different era. You know, people I know associate it really generally, and I've mentioned this on the podcast before. I'm speaking out of school with Pete Laney, I think, is the person you're most likely to probably see that attributed to. Now, you know, if we were to ask former Speaker Laney about that, he might tell us where he got it. It might have been a previous speaker, but we'll set that aside for now. Now, you know, and that the more a speaker is known generally, and I was looking at some of our past data, and we don't have a lot of data on this, but again, roughly speaking, the more the more you become known, if you become well-known, it's generally not that good for your public opinion standing. Now, you know, you can think about the causality of that a couple of different ways. So, you know, and it certainly in the case of the current speaker, you know, becoming more well-known and becoming a subject of public discussion, you know, has not been good for his numbers to, you know, spoiler alert.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, hearing you talk about it, and I mean, we've talked about, you know, the Laney rule before and this notion about public opinion and the speaker. And I've never really thought about, you know, the mechanics of it so much as because it hasn't really been an issue. And obviously now it's becoming more of an issue. But what's interesting about that is it's not even so much that, you know, their statewide numbers become a problem directly. It's indirectly, right? It's because, you know, if the speaker becomes that well-known, they become an issue either way. And if you think about it, I'm just thinking out loud now, you know, in a house that, you know, that generally you see, you know, even at the end of the process, usually pretty far, you know, wide bipartisan support for whoever the speaker is, at least in the final voting tally.
By the process, you mean of selecting the speaker?
Yeah, of selecting the speaker within the House. You know, I mean, at least the ones I've seen most often, it's not been like a close vote. It's usually, you know, pretty much everybody selecting somebody. Now, what that sort of speaks to is at a certain point, you know, when the speaker becomes well known, that can become a problematic vote for some people or lots of people, right? As the speaker becomes an object of, you know, whatever, evaluation even.
Right. I mean, I think there's still, you know, as we'll see, a question of how broad that is.
Yeah.
But, it's interesting because at that point, I mean, you know, the question is how much of this is psychology and intra-group dynamics and how much of it is a matter of public politics. And I think the intersection of that in this
what's interesting and kind of tricky about this. You know, we talk about the fact that, you know, the speaker's race is a race for, you know, one person to be hired by the rest of the House, you know, essentially to distribute power, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that's a big deal, right?
Right.
It's a huge deal.
You know,
But to
which is what makes it such an internal thing, and why figuring out these the external facing element
exactly.
of it is very interesting
and tricky, right?
Right.
So let's look at the external facing.
So if we look at if we look at the overall trend lines, you know, and a look at the overall trend lines really provides at least some grounding for this kind of discussion, and that, you know, the idea that when the speaker became a subject of a new level of sustained, direct, and public criticism during the last session, you know, his job approval ratings dipped and his disapproval climbed.
Right.
Allowing for, you know, a steady share of between about a fifth and a quarter who had no view of him. And if you're listening to this on a podcast platform, by the time this is up, at the Texas Politics Project website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu, we'll post a lot of the data we're talking about, in particular this trend data, so you can have a look at that. And if you want to, you know, do that and go listen there or look while you're listening, just follow the link to the blog section of the website, and it'll be near this. The podcast with the data will be near the top of that.
Right.
So the trend line is pretty clear, right?
Yeah. I mean, if we look, you know, where we are right now, just to give us where we were in August, you know, 21% of Texas voters said they approved of the job that Speaker Phelan is doing. 27% disapproved. 52% couldn't provide an opinion either way. Either said they neither had an opinion or just, you know, didn't know. Right.
Yeah.
We look at Republicans. Right. And this is really the key, you know, the key groups here for this whole issue. Right. 27% held a favorable view. 21% held an unfavorable view. Again, about half no opinion, but net positive. Just to be clear here, it's not as though the speaker has generated a bunch of goodwill among Democrats because the House impeached Phelan. No, again, and we'll get to what nobody cares, but it's 7 Democrats, 17 approve of the job he's doing, 34% disapprove, 49 don't know. Again, a lot of that probably has to do just with knowing the partisanship of the House even. You know, I'm not even sure I think that's probably an overstatement of Democratic knowledge of who Phelan is, to be quite
honest. Yeah, I mean, generally, if you look at our, you know, a lot of these approval numbers, if, you know, particularly people like Phelan and other actors a little, you know, less in the public eye than, say, the governor and the president, even the lieutenant governor.
Right.
I think if there's a good argument, this would actually be a good piece to, you know, to suggest, as you say, that, you know, you ask Democrats about state government 20-plus years into the Republican monopoly of governance and state elected offices and both chambers of the legislature— if you're a Democrat, you know, you probably developed a reflex that just says, yeah, I just don't approve of those guys.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of like, you know, not crazy or surprising, you know. And I think, and then, you know, something honestly related to that is we're seeing that increasingly among independents too, right? Because it's not like they like Democrats, but Democrats aren't really the object of their attention most of the time in Texas.
And I think it's, you know, and so it's interesting to look at that trend line figure and see the clear, you know, a clear sign of when things got much tougher for Phelan.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, that trend line is pretty clear over the last couple of years. I mean, among Republican voters, his net job approval, you know, the difference between his approval and disapproval closes remarkably just between April and June of 2023. Yeah. It goes from among Republicans, it goes from plus 30 to just plus 6. And I remember when we saw that, we wondered if that was just going to be a glitch and it was going to go back up. And it, you know, it's wavered a little bit since then, but it's not gone back into, you know, a net positive rating of him of double figures since that June of 2023 poll. Now, that seems not that long ago, but, you know, we've got, you know, 8 polls since then, something like that, right? And so, you know, the timing of that drop, obviously, again, between April and June of 2023, you know, coincides with deepening public hostility in the relationship between the speaker and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, in which the hostility of that, and part of this, as we'll get to, is an artifact of the media environment, but that hostility is, you know, very public and very direct in a way that even during the worst days of the Strauss speakership, and by the worst days, I mean, you know, the most conflict between then Speaker Strauss and Lieutenant Governor Patrick, even in the worst period of that, was not as open. And then, you know, that negativity escalates with the impeachment of Attorney General Paxton in the House, and then what many see as the lieutenant governor's engineering of Paxton's exoneration in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, amidst all of this then, putting further pressure on these numbers, Phelan's opponents fund a, you know, very serious primary challenge back in his House district, which Phelan barely beats back. Now, we could still say to that, but, and yet...
And yet he did, right? I mean, ultimately, and that's you know, the other issue here, which is, and yet most people aren't paying attention to this. I mean, as you're going through all that, I'm thinking to myself about the change in these numbers. And one of the questions I can't answer, but I can decompose, is like, well, what led to those changes, right? And I don't know the exact distribution of this, but I can decompose it and say some of that is, you know, the most attentive Republicans watching what's going on, looking at the impeachment, looking at the way that Patrick has aligned against Phelan. And maybe prior to that, given, again, multiple, or at least I'll say two specifically, very conservative legislative sessions, right, which produced a ton of conservative legislation. And then you see this drop. So some of that drop is going to be the attentive Republicans. Some of that is going to be actually people who have never heard of Phelan at all, but now this is the first thing they're hearing about him, is that he, you know, fill in the blank, you know, I'm putting this in quotes and italics, you know, orchestrated the impeachment of Paxton, or he, you know, stood in the way of vouchers or whatever. And the thing that, you know, I think we talked about this at various points in time, but I'll point it out again. And, you know, other than Phelan sort of, you know, standing up for himself, there's really no organized allied group to give the opposite message.
Yeah.
You know, at that point, especially during the impeachment, you know, trial, there weren't a bunch of, you know, there wasn't a bunch of money being spent to say, actually, these are valid claims, or actually most of the House voted. And so, you know, that's, as we talked about a lot, the information environment in which, you know, again, people who were developing an opinion about Phelan that they maybe didn't have before was going to be really negative. And I think that's something that we kind of see here.
And as we commented at the time, and you know, I think we were commenting about this, as I recall, at least on the podcast, mainly in response to fluctuations in views of the Paxton impeachment, views of Paxton at the time, you know, is because we know, as we say in here all the time, that on issues that voters don't, or issues, or in this case, people, that voters don't have well-developed opinions about, they look to partisan, you know, for cues to their partisan opinion leaders and elected officials. And this was a very conflictive time if you were looking to more well-known Republican elected officials for cues on what you should think about this.
Yeah, and if you think about it, if you're feeling, you're like, I've got Rick Perry,
know,
which is, I mean, which was about honestly the most probably well-known person he could really mobilize to his cause.
And the, you know, as we'll, as you know, we'll get to a little bit later, but still, or we'll explore a little bit later, Phelan, you know, the governor, you know, who would have been somebody who's weighing in, could have been probably to have a decisive influence on people. The governor kind of stayed out of it and was, and, you know, at least publicly, and was very, you know, quiet and kind of above, tried to be above the fray at, in terms of the Paxton impeachment and the fighting between Phelan and Patrick in the, during the regular session of that year. And, you know, while the governor has been more restrained in and diplomatic, strategic, I think, in the ensuing months or ensuing year or so since then, you know, the silence, I think, spoke volumes. is one way of saying that. And there were, and clearly there were indications behind the scenes in terms of the governor's, you know, relatively unprecedented intervention in House races and over the voucher issue, et cetera. So, but still, given all you know, the data that we had about the runoff and about the, and about Phelan's challenge in the primary suggests that for all of this, people were still, were not, I mean, most people were not following this.
Yeah, right. In April of this year, when we asked people how much they'd heard about the runoff election in the district of Representative Dade Phelan, Speaker of the Texas House, and yes, we put all that information in there on purpose so that we could say, you know, whatever you've heard about, you know, whether it's the speaker's, you know, the speaker's race, whether it's about Dade Phelan, whatever it is, we're trying to get that in there. Only 14% of Texas voters said they'd heard a lot about the runoff election, including only 13% of Republicans, 16% of self-identified conservatives, and at the high end, 26% of those who said they're extremely conservative. So that's, you know, the target audience, I think, within primaries, but that speaks to the point here. Significantly less Texans overall. in June 2024, after the results of that, we had, well, how much have you heard about the results of the runoff election in the district of Representative David Phelan, Speaker of Texas? Again, only 14% said a lot. Again, only 13% of Republicans said a lot. Only 13% of conservatives. Only 20% of extreme conservatives. I like that that went down because it wasn't actually the outcome. I think that, you know, in some ways,
right.
There's a little motivated reason here about what kind of news you pay attention to, right?
Right. But I mean, what strikes me about that is that, you know, that number among extreme conservatives went down, but also how consistent those mm-hmm. two numbers are.
Yeah, very consistent.
You know, which, you know, is an interesting kind of thumbnail.
Yeah.
You know, for what, you know, these kinds of politics. And on the other side, it's just worth noting that, you know, we're not hiding the ball here or anything. You know, in that April 24 poll about just the runoff, the existence or that the runoff was taking place, 57% said they'd heard not much or nothing. And a quarter, and very similar numbers in the following, you know, as you would imagine, since the front end numbers were similar. Very similar numbers in June, I think 59% say they haven't heard very much or nothing at all. In both polls, about a quarter say they've heard nothing at all.
This is a great Chad Schneider moment. Maybe we'll come back to it, but I'll wait. see if there's a point for it.
You know, so all this brings us to, you know, one of the points here, I think, that is, you know, absent a clear scandal or other massive external factor that really, mm-hmm. you know, just draws attention. It would have to be pretty cataclysmic, I think. You know, a speaker's race does come down, as you were saying, to politics in the chamber. And I think we can argue that some of these external politics have seeped in more, and I'll talk about, you know, kind of some hypotheses on that. But, you know, I think it's fair. I think, and you may or may not, you know, I think Phelan's numbers, such as they are, you know, are unlikely to have much direct impact either in his favor or against him.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that nobody's going to mention it or they, you know, they won't be in some ways misrepresented, which I want to get to, which they have.
Yeah.
But it's not like anybody's going to stand up and go, look, Dade Phelan's, you know, net approval numbers have really gotten bad since the last session. We need a new speaker. That's not really the argument that's out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question, this is where I was going back to, you know, what I said before about the mechanics of this. And I think, you know, given what we're saying about the internal politics and how this is really about, you know, power dynamics and you know, all kinds of coalitional and intercoalitional politics. But I think, you know, and again, I'm not a member, so I'm not trying to speak, you know, as if I were. But I'm just, you know, thinking to myself, if I were in that position, where would these numbers matter? You know, where would Phelan's numbers make a difference in my decision? And the question becomes, you know, would supporting or opposing Phelan have an impact on me in my next election? That's
right.
Really the fundamental question. You know, does supporting Phelan mean it's going to be harder for me to win a Republican primary the next time around, right? And to the extent that Phelan remains, you know, below the radar, you know, for the most part, it's less of a factor. Now, the issue is that, you know, there's this intensity question, right? Which is to say, well, yeah, you know, it's not that, you know, information about this is, you know, randomly distributed across the electorate. It's probably the case that the messages that are negative about Phelan, and I think we probably see this here, you know, they're most prevalent amongst the most sort of conservative, most engaged kind of voters who are really paying attention to this kind of stuff. Those are also the people that we think tend to have, like, you know, an influence in the primaries, right? So
yeah.
It's not necessarily the case. And I think, you know, maybe this is a way in which, you know, the Laney rule would be updated, and some, there might be some caveats as we move ahead, given all the things, you know, we're talking about changing the environment. But it almost seems like it's not so much about, you know, more than half of the, I mean, half the public knowing is kind of a thumbnail, like, rule, maybe. It's kind of a sketch idea. Like, well, once you get past there, and part of that, if anything, is because it implies something else, which is, if more than the general public, the registered voter pool, has an opinion about you as speaker, it's very likely that the most engaged partisans on both sides have an opinion about you.
Yeah.
And that's maybe where the problem starts to come in. When Phelan's leadership itself becomes an issue for another member, then the politics of it go outside of what we think of as really inside baseball, inside the building, distribution of power, of agenda control. All of a sudden, then it goes to this other thing. And that's where I think it's difficult as a speaker to maneuver.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree that, the calculation of self-interest on members and, you know, at the top of that or close to the top of that is, you know, how much trouble is this going to cause me,
mm-hmm.
you know, in my next election? And under the circumstances, it is going to be mostly a matter of primary politics.
And usually the answer is no, right? I mean, just if you take a normal, if we just say, like, hey, it's an open speaker's race, It could be any one of these guys that literally nobody in Texas besides some people in their district have any idea who they are, thoughts about them. Well, then it can totally, I mean, again, the alternative here is useful. Then it can totally come down to the internal politics. You know, what are you offering me? What is this going to do for me and my voters, my constituents, the party, maybe secondarily?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing in here that really helps Phelan per se. There's nothing he can use for leverage. He can't say the public has rallied around him.
No.
You know, the best he can do is to say, look, you know, this looks like more or less business as usual in terms mm-hmm. of what polling, you know, this was the discussion to be had, looks like around the speaker. But what's going on here isn't about me. It's about, disgruntled outs jockeying for power, an authoritarian lieutenant governor, the ambitions of others.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of other things that are going to take pride of place other than him trying to claim any kind of, mandate or not. Now, his opponents, as I was alluding to a minute ago, can say, and they have said frequently on social media and in their messaging, that, he doesn't have high levels of support from his own partisans. Now, this is a little dishonest in the sense that speakers never do.
Right, exactly.
Given the kind of numbers we're talking about. But, even given that, there's really not a lot here for his opponents to draw on, at least not if they're going to be, reasonably intellectually honest or even just straightforwardly honest about it.
Yeah, which I would say in this case, matters more, probably matters more than it does in normal public politics, right, in some ways, because this isn't an argument that's being made to the voters about, this is an argument being made to other members.
Yeah.
Right? You're saying, no, his public persona is a problem for you. Well, ultimately, you have to convince that member that that's true. And that's actually a pretty heavy lift, I think, in this
case.
Yeah,
I think so, too. I mean, I don't know if you mentioned it before the podcast or now, there's a, motivated reasoning will do a lot of lifting in this.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, look.
on everybody's part, in the scenario you're talking about.
Yeah, well, and look, we don't need to get into the details, or I don't know if we're going to get into these kind of details, but that statement is true until it's not, which is a great way to cover myself, but by which I mean, it's a heavy lift to say that, public attitudes towards the speaker are going to affect you personally as a member. Having said that, we'll kind of talk about this maybe, to the extent that, there's ideas out there that all of the Democrats might align with some of the Republicans for, either a Phelan, another Phelan speakership or even somebody else. I think that's where this would get tested, because at that point, all of a sudden, if you're one of these minority of Republicans who go along with the Democrats, I'm not saying it's going to happen. I don't think this is. But let's say they did. All of a sudden, your support of the speaker, regardless of what people thought about it, does become an issue in your next election because you aligned with the Democrats. But that's actually the point again. It's not necessarily because, you aligned with a rhino speaker or whatever, anything like that people are going to say. It's because, no, you voted with all the Democrats. That's actually what's going to be the thing that becomes the issue here. So even that kind of actually furthers this idea that it's not really the speaker's persona itself so much as if the support of whoever this person is becomes an issue. Because honestly, to my mind, if the ultimate ending candidates become, a choice between Representative Cook, let's say, and somebody not named Phelan who's also a Republican, I don't think the outcome of that vote is going to make any difference in any Republicans' primary elections, unless one of those members is overtly anti-vouchers or overtly anti-Ken Paxton or something that would just already disqualify them some way of being in that position to begin with.
Yeah,
there's a lot of stuff.
I'm trying
there.
To follow all the
sorry.
Elements of that scenario, but I think.
Thank you.
but I think it's. So, what do we make of this? I mean, so you've kind of broached the race now. No, it's good. I wanted to go there. I mean, this does sort of, speak to a few current events. I mean, or more recent developments in this, the meeting last week at the county line in which, a group of, it's a little unclear, what the nature of the representation here was. Some staff members were there representing offices, their elected officials. Some of the elected officials were there, but some of the elected officials to be were at this meeting. The count varied.
Yeah.
Initially, it was going to be 25.
That's later, the number in my mind.
Later on, somebody was saying that there were as many as, depending on how you count it, as many as 50.
So huge crowd sizes.
In the realm of 50 votes, you know, and I again,
yeah.
I'm sure we could get email on this about how, you know, we know what the facts are, but I'm not sure we do.
Well, I'll say this, we don't know, and there's a lot of reason for people involved to say the numbers were larger than they were.
Yeah,
so
right.
That's all. So I'll say, I heard the same numbers you originally, 25, but that was before the meeting happened. What happened?
Yeah, I think after, when the meeting was happening, you know, people were saying that there were more than 25, but again, like, what counted as representation, I think, is still a little bit vague in my mind.
Right.
And happy to hear more about this from listeners. But, you know, to the extent that his opponents have succeeded in clearing the field, coalescing a group of feeling opponents around Representative David Cook, who you mentioned earlier, you know, nominally, it does seem like Phelan's position appears weakened. I mean, you were kind of talking about this a little bit before the podcast.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you look at, you know, and I know this, people can have various arguments about this, but if you look at sort of the ideological distribution of House members, right, and it's useful. I mean, ultimately, I want to just say at the outset, there are no moderate, you know, House Republicans. I mean, everybody, this is all relative flavors of conservatism. So I'm not calling anybody a moderate here in this left-right continuum. I'm not saying anybody's a liberal. Just wanted forestall any emails. But if you look actually, you know, you look at the candidates who coalesced around Cook and you look at where Cook is really right in the middle of the, you know, ideological distribution of the Republican caucus, at least per public votes. And if you look at the prior candidates who supported him, they actually came from pretty far across the ideological spectrum, with Shelby Slauson sort of furthest to the right, James Frank furthest to the left. Again, all on the right. We're all on the right here, right?
Furthest to the less right.
Yeah, further to the less right. So one, you know, that's at least on its face is kind of plausible. To the extent you think, like, you know, someone like Slauson or Oliverson, the idea that, like, you know, they are coming with them holding some number of votes, otherwise, you know, they wouldn't necessarily have put their name in the ring to begin with if they didn't have some support that they could potentially at least, you know, carry with them or move. We'll see.
Yeah.
But if that's the idea, then, again, this is also, you know, we don't know, but the idea is then there are some votes coming from different parts of the GOP coalition. And then what we also know is, based on the primaries, if you look at that same distribution of representatives, a lot of the members who were removed via the primary process or who retired because of, you know, threats or other reasons came from the left-hand side of that spectrum. So all of this is to say, you know, if you're saying, you know, where was Speaker Phelan before? And we've talked about this, said, you know, before this week, you'd say, hey, he's still probably, you know, the highest likelihood person of being Speaker again. That doesn't mean 90%. It just means the highest likelihood probability. Has that probability gone down, you know, probably, you know, significantly for me in the last, you know, week or two? Yeah, I would say so. Now, it doesn't mean it's down to zero or he's not, you know, a significant possibility in here, but it's looking a little bit more challenging to find his way back.
I was tempted to ask you what the number was, if it's not zero, if it's more than 50%, you know, or less than 50%.
No, it was never more than 50%. I mean, my thinking was that, you know, part of it is, you know, you looked at the people who were already out there, and I'm not saying they had high probabilities, but they take some probability. And then you got to figure there's some share of the probability that goes to the unnamed person who's ultimately likely to be the actual next speaker, who we just don't know who that is, right? And that's probably one of the highest probability outcomes. But if we talk about the named people, you know, my thinking was Phelan was probably in somewhere in the 20-30% probability range, like, again, the plurality choice, you know. And then I think now, you know, I think that's more like, you know, 15-20% maybe. I mean, you know, maybe a little less.
I think he's still in better position than that myself, just because I don't, unless, you know, somehow we find out that David Cook turns out to be a better alternative to Democrats.
Yeah.
But
don't know how the caucus rules are going to play out on this, right? So, I mean, my understanding, just, you know, for people who pay attention here, is that, you know, essentially the GOP caucus has passed rule that says that, you know, essentially you're going to need a supermajority support in the caucus to basically be the speaker candidate. If somebody gets supermajority in the caucus, the idea is that, you know, even if you oppose that person as a Republican, you're supposed to support them in the public vote.
Yeah, supposed to.
And again, but honestly, this is how, I mean, I guess I game this out. Part of this is to say, yes, supposed to, and I agree. But, like, if you're sitting there as part of the, you know, 2/5, let's say, of Republicans who aren't necessarily behind or haven't just agreed to, you know, a consensus candidate, you know, the one thing you guarantee if you join up with the Democrats to support Phelan or anybody else is you're going to get primary challenge next time. And I think that was a very, very costly proposition this time around that is going to be on members' minds. And, you know, I think we've had some recent examples. We don't have to go into the podcast, but there are a lot of recent examples where there are some Republicans who have reticence about going along with the group, but then faced with the reality that the group is going that way, don't want the trouble, right? And I, you know, I sort of think that if close to that number within the caucus can agree on somebody, which is a big if, I think that becomes a real, real challenge. I just don't see how that person is feeling right now, especially on this main thing, which is the Democratic committee chair issue. You know, Phelan could switch on that and say, no, I'm not going to give any Democratic committee chairs either. And that would be a big switch and would be, I think, useful to him at this point. But as of right now, if this is about the distribution of power and worrying about your next primary, you know, whether or not you're going to get primary challenge next time, you have one person who, you know, if you vote for him, you're not going to get primary challenge because you didn't support Phelan, first of all. And this person is already saying, I've got more committee chairs to give out. So what's the pitch on the other side?
Yeah, no. Well, I think there is a pitch, and the pitch is, you know, you can turn some of those people.
Yeah, no, I'm asking. I'm curious.
You can turn some of those people once it becomes inevitable. I mean, if you look at kind of the, you know, the internal qualitative history of these House races, there's always this moment that we're in right now where people are kind of making the self-interested calculations you're doing and, you know, whatever else, you know, particular members drop into that, their feelings about the Senate, their feelings about Lieutenant Governor Patrick in this case.
That's a tricky extra factor.
Right,
here.
Which I think is, you know, again, a hard, you know, we talked about it, a hard factor to weigh.
It is very hard to weigh.
Because it's not, you know, it's not as concrete and readily recognizable as one's anxiety about a primary challenge.
Yeah,
but it's there in a kind of, you know, inchoate sort of way, but it's there.
And there's not a straight line, obviously, between those attitudes and what it manifests even.
You know, part of the factor here, I think, is going to be how bad does Dade Phelan want to be speaker? Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you know, how much will the Democratic caucus hang together in his favor? Now, we don't know the answer to either of those. But, you know, historically, and this was in the key caveat here is that this was in a much less ideologically sorted and polarized political system. But historically, you know, it is, at the end of the day, a race to 76 to get in the chair. And then you get in the chair and you sort those other problems out once you're in the chair. And I don't disagree with you that, you know, it's a disruptive fight in the caucus and at the primary level if Phelan says, you know what, I want to be speaker no matter what. Yeah. He, you know, arrives at some marketable position with the Democrats on Democratic chairs that also, and we talked about this quite a while ago, that uses the fungibility of that situation to soften some of the opposition in conjunction with offering the kinds of things you mentioned, like more committee chairs. So, for example, if you said, look, what I'm going to, you go to the Democrats and say, I'm not going to, you know, I don't know if this is going on or not, but, you know, I am not going to commit to no Democratic committee chairs, but I am going to commit to a reduction in this and to phasing this model out under my remaining speakership, which means there will be fewer Democratic committee chairs next time. And your option, you know, your option is fewer or none.
Right.
Right. And how many Democrats can you bring along with that and reduce the number and reduce the number of votes you need from your own caucus? But in doing that, you also increase the number of chairs you have to distribute. And it's that fungibility, but that I think is the key factor here in terms of thinking about, you know, and what's happened in the past is when you get to 76, you know, and this goes to your point about how these races are often consensual. Once it looks like somebody's going to win, people want to jump on board. I mean, there are, you know, tales in some of the video that we've got from, to go back a ways, the speaker race in which Billy Clayton succeeded Price Daniel Jr. in the early to mid 70s, 74, I guess, in which, you know, there are tales of literally, you know, they're having the caucus meetings in the Driscoll, and the word is circulating that they're at 76, and people are, you know, running towards the elevator where the then, you know, where Clayton's team was going, wait, wait, we want to be on board.
Right.
And people are, and the doors are closing and they're going kind of, well, you know, too late.
Yeah.
You know, but it, but that's why I say it really does kind of hinge on, you know, how badly does Phelan really want this? And I think, look, all the signs that we're seeing now, you know, particularly, you know, him bringing in people like Mike Toomey and Rick Perry, is that, you know, they're going to the mats, all right, they're going to the mattresses, to use the Godfather term, right? I mean, they are going to, you know, they want to retain the speakership, and they are going to do this, you know, whatever the longer game is. And you may still be right that the longer game may be bad. I mean, I think you are right. That longer game could wind up being bad for some of these members unless the session happens, they get together, they win the speakership, the Democrats are kind of locked into it and, you know, Phelan mends some fences in some ways.
Yeah, this is really, I mean.
Now, that may or may not be possible at this point, but, I mean, there are ways to maybe try to alleviate some of that pressure going forward. And if you really game this out, some of this is going to depend on what the political environment looks like in the 2026 election, and that, in fact, is going to be strongly influenced by who wins the presidential race. So we've gone from like the most interior of Texas, you know, institutional politics to the big picture, you know, the big context of that election does matter a lot.
Yeah, it's all really interesting. I mean, I think the thing that, you know, you've convinced me of here is, you know, the importance of Phelan's commitment to the speakership, you know, and winning. I mean, that really is a fun, I mean, you know, if you think about, there's so much that is sort of unknowable and behind the scenes and all that stuff. But if you think about one factor that really does tell you, like, whether and if so, how messy this could turn, it's Phelan's willingness to basically engage the Democrats in a deal and see who we can get to come along. And then the question becomes, there's two sort of things that fall out of that
right.
for me.
Yeah.
One is, you know, to your point, you know, and I think this speaks to some changes in the environment questions, you know.
Yeah.
So one is, you know, so you get to 76 and the writing's on the wall, and then the question becomes, how many of the other Republicans fall in with that and say, you know, I don't want to be on the outside looking in, to your point. I don't want to be outside the elevator at this point. There's still a bunch yeah. of, there's still a bunch of committees to go around past seven, you know, given how many Democrats there are and how many Republicans you need, there's still a bunch of other committees to chair, a bunch of work to be done.
The speaker can do a lot of things for people.
Yeah. And so the question becomes, you know, one.
For his voters.
Yeah. One, how quickly are sort of the non-Phelan Republicans, you know, scared off? That's sort of one question to me, or scared into line. And that's an interesting thought.
Scared or incentivized.
Yeah.
I mean, fear is a type of incentive, I guess.
Yeah, but, yeah, sure.
You know, positive and negative incentives.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah, that's right. And to make this clear, like, it doesn't matter. I mean, they're both there. The mix is there. You know, for an individual at a point in time, it'll be what it's going to be. So that's interesting. The other thing I think is interesting about that whole dynamic is, you know, I wonder what Phelan standing with the Democrats does look like here. You know, and again, we're not talking about statewide polling. We're talking about within the caucus. You know, I mean, if you think about it, yes, I mean, there is a sort of, you know, the enemy of my enemies is my friend kind of mentality here that could win the day. And obviously, Phelan would be, you know, significantly better deal to Democrats than almost anybody else who's going to win the gavel, you know, based on the dynamics we're talking about here, unless there's something totally different, right? But at the same time, I can't help but think, you know, this is the speaker who did deliver two of the most conservative, you know, Texas legislative sessions in history, as many people will sort of attest to. You know, this is a speaker who did, you know, sort of, you know, kind of famously say with his, you know, purple glasses, I'm done bashing on, you know, the gays and the lesbians and all that stuff. And then kind of oversaw a pretty continuous bashing on LGBTQ
right.
people. And so, you know, I don't think it's one of those things where one of the things that probably benefits Phelan is what we're talking about here, which is that, you know, his low profile among Democratic voters and the fact that he's not going to be an issue for Democratic House members, you know, in terms of who they voted for in the speaker's race, you know, that's not going to be something that's going to come up in their primary election next time. So, like, I don't see that as necessarily a thing, but I do wonder to what extent, you know, when he says, hey, I've got a deal for you, how well that's received among, you know, sort of Democratic
yeah,
decision
makers. Yeah, no, and that's,
makers,
a, you know, I mean, well, you know,
other, than, other than to say it's better than anything else you're going to get.
And
that's
going to depend on the deal,
yes.
right? And that's going to, you know, entail some bargaining. So,
well, I was going to say, I mean, just as a transition to some other points you just want to close out with, I mean, but this is harder now, right? I mean, I think part of what's interesting is, like, this is all, you know, in some ways, you know, we can talk about this and these old saws, and I think about, you know, kind of the people that I, you know, started learning about Texas politics from, and a lot of them seem to be retiring, and, you know, this idea that this is so internal and opaque and all this kind of stuff, and yet at the same time, like, you know, at least in my experience, I mean, this is one of the most sort of public in a lot of ways, you know, races, at least I've seen, you know, recently. And I don't mean, again, this is all still taking place behind the scene, but the amount of attention paid to it. So it does seem like some fundamental changes in the environment have taken place.
Yeah. I mean, I was just going to, yeah. I mean, I think that's a good transition to close it out. I mean, I was just going to say, you know, there's a few things. I mean, having, you know, regaled with a story about the 70s, you know, I don't want to seem too locked into that, you know, and mention, you know, having mentioned Billy Clayton and Pete Laney in the same podcast about speakerships, you know, I mean, all of this does point to, like, you know, interesting questions about, and I think the outcome of this is going to be very material to this, about the degree to which the context and the structural institutional factors around, you know, the selection of the speaker has changed. And, you know, a few of those clearly, you know, and we've kind of had occasion that this is already kind of, we bumped up against this in the discussion, you know, media changes. Look, in the longer term, you know, the media environment, you know, I mean, to use the race I was talking about before, the Billy Clayton, the speaker race that produced Billy Clayton as speaker, you know, the media environment, very different, you know, and I think, you know, we leap right, you know, to social media now, and I think that's fair. I mean, you know, much of this fight has taken place over social media, and a lot of the heat came from social media, and that's been going on for a little while. I mean, the most vicious fighting over the last three speakers, Strauss, Bonin, now Phelan, really metastasized and was fed over social media, particularly Twitter. And, you know, that seeps into the coverage. And then the other, you know, piece of this, which is kind of the intermediate piece, which I think gets missed. I mean, the social media thing everybody's talking about now, but I think the intermediate piece, and we were talking about this beforehand, and I kind of, you know, this kind of occurred to me as I was working on lectures for the intro class a few years ago. You know, and in the longer term, I think you have the rise of a kind of more specialized political media is really important to understanding this. You know, in the longer term, I mean, you know, this, we're seeing this at the national level too. I mean, you know, ground zero for this is, like, you know, the creation of Politico, right? But then in Texas, we've seen our own. There were always things like, you know, Ross Ramsey's Texas Weekly, Harvey Kronberg's Quorum Report, you know, these very focused that began really essentially as newsletters has really, you know, metastasized and not metastasized is the wrong word, has really evolved. I mean, and it's spread. I mean, there's just more attention to inside baseball. You've got, you know, you've got the Texas Tribune, and, you know, particularly when the Tribune started, I think honestly they've, you know, they're not as attentive to this stuff as they used to be, or not as focused on it. You know, it's up to them mission-wise, but a lot of attention to inside baseball in very specialized media outlets. You know, you've got the Texas Tribune, you've got the Texan, you know, now you've got the new left sort of thing, Crooked, not Crooked, it'll come to me in a second. And I apologize to the people running that now I can't remember what it's called. It's just, I don't have it in my notes. We'll put a link to you guys in the in the podcast post. You know, all of that just fed attention to things that are very internal, into the internal baseball. And like the social media, it's not that, you know, everybody is now reading those things, but political reporters at the right, at the more general outlets are reading that stuff, and they see them as their competition, and it's fed competition for those stories, and the attention to that breaks stories that seep into mainstream media.
Yeah, I was going to say, it informs their coverage. I mean, it is remarkable to think that, you know, the Republicans organizing, you know, or trying to consolidate, you know, against Phelan. It's like, we knew where and when the meeting was before it happened, and then there were people there. I mean, it was just sort of, right. Like, I mean, it was like, it's just a, I mean, not to say it's an open secret, because it's not a secret. I mean, it's just sort of, this information is, like, readily available. And to your point, you know, it may not be covered by the major dailies per se, but all those reporters, they know this is going on.
Well, what happens is that it gets, you know, when it's just at the rumor stage or the speculative stage, it gets covered in the niche outlets and on social media. But that triggers coverage once it blooms, if you will, it becomes a more conventional confirmed story. It gets picked up in the mainstream outlets, you know, and then, of course, there's, you know, the factor that we bring into everything, but because it matters, you know, when you've got more ideologically sorted parties in a state with, you know, that's had a one-party governance pattern for the last 20 years, the conflicts within the Republican Party, like this one, just makes the politics around the speakership more pronounced. Like, as you were, you know, parsing out, like, well, there's this faction of Republicans, and how many is that? And, you know, and we look at that stuff all the time. I mean, that just gets more pronounced. And again, to go back, that's not unlike what that is not unlike what we saw during the period of Democratic dominance.
Yeah.
But there was more ideological breadth in the Democratic Party of the 60s and 70s than there is in the Republican Party post 2000.
Right, but it doesn't mean that the fights over agenda control are any less vicious or
if anything maybe more.
Yeah, that's right. They're even more consequential in some ways, right?
People are looking for, you know, are looking more broad, you know, more thoroughly for ways of distinguishing themselves on an ideological basis.
For scraps, really.
Yeah, and making this, you know, the argument that we're seeing, which is, you know, who is the true conservative?
Right.
Right? And that was not the kind of campaign theme that you saw in those speakers' fights inside the Democratic Party in the 50s, 60s, 70s, right? Even into the 80s to some degree. I mean, it was there, you know, and the upshot was that what you usually got, speaking of Billy Clayton and Pete Laney, was a more moderate to conservative rural Democratic member.
Yeah. Someone
this dynamic is a little, it's a little more, you know, the word that came to mind, I'm just going to use it, but it's a little more ideologically inbred. You know, to your point, I mean, making the distinction between...
I like that analogy.
You know, would anybody look at, you know, if you set aside the personalities involved and Dan Patrick and Dade Feely, you know, whatever, and you look, I mean, and we see this from the outside when we look at, see national media looking in, would anybody really look at what's been going on in the Texas legislature, you know, from a broad ideological perspective or even a, you know, snug in the Overton window, would you go, you know, man, they're not really very conservative there in Texas, are they?
You know, it's funny.
What's going on? That must be Dade Phelan's fault.
I mean,
ridiculous.
One of the most frustrating calls I got, you know, in the lead up to the primary was from a national outlet where the reporter said, so my understanding is that Abbott is funding a lot of primary challengers against Republicans in his own party because they're moderates. And I was like, well, buddy, let me just say.
Let's go back.
I was like, I think that's what he would like you to believe. Yes. But that goes to the point is like, there are no moderates. Like, you know, John Campbell, not a moderate. Like, let's just, you know, take a step back and just say none of these people, to be fair,
there are, you know, there are gradations here.
Yeah. And they're different and there are different dimensions of, you know, ideology, right?
But adopting the language of one faction or another doesn't really.
And the point here is moderate is meant to be pejorative, right?
That's exactly right.
That's the point. So let's,
is a good point.
It doesn't matter. I mean, I'm not, you know, it's intended as a pejorative in this case.
And then lest we hear from, you know, some of our other listeners, we should also add to this, obviously, you know, the ability to inject money and visibility into a speaker's fight as a result of first speaker candidates having to register with the Secretary of State, which is a relatively new adaptation, you know, from, you know, this century. And the fact that it's been, you know, verified or, you know, legally sort of confirmed that you can spend money on running for speaker as long as you follow some rules has also changed the dynamics of these races. You know, this kind of goes back to something like, you know, I was going to slightly disagree with you earlier and just, you know, I'll flag it now, which is the, you know, the idea that, you know, going into like the meeting on Friday, you know, everybody came in with some votes. Well,
Maybe. Yeah.
Right. Because there's a lot of, you know, there's an additional incentive now to simply become a candidate to burnish your own political profile and to make you and to position yourself for something else that might not be speaker.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, the Senate seat in your, we're not going to single anybody out, like the Senate seat in your district.
Right.
Or, and let us also, you know, remember that by all indications, with the magnitude of this on each side being shaped by the outcome of the presidential election, the 2026 primaries here at the statewide level are going to have a lot of participants. Or certainly at this point, there are a lot of people thinking about moving on up.
Right. I think that's exactly right. And I think politics is one of these, you know, the most unusual places where, you know, ultimately any reason to actually ask your donors for money is a good reason, right? If you're in the conversation, if you have a reason to, again, ask your donors, go meet new donors, go talk to expand your political network because you're looking for to maybe move beyond what's maybe a district level role to a statewide role, whether that's in the speaker's race or something beyond, is really, you know, it's an opportunity. And so I think, yeah, that's right here, which is to some extent, that also speaks to some extent why not everybody who jumps in a speaker's race is serious about being speaker.
Yeah, right. Which, yeah, that's exactly what I meant. Yeah. So, so with that, that's a lot of data and, you know, a little bit of a theory of the case even. Thanks to Josh for joining and all the prep on this. As always, thanks to our excellent production team in the dev studio here in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin, who during the recording of this podcast demonstrated a remarkable ability to handle a crisis and stay on their feet. Again, we talked about a lot of data in this podcast. If you haven't already gone there, try texaspolitics.utexas.edu. We'll have this podcast embedded in a post in our blog section that will have a lot of the illuminative data we used on this, particularly this trend data on the speaker stuff, which is, I think, very interesting, even if you're not that into data. So most of all, thanks to you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.